The Norton Lectures were established to further our understanding within the Christian Church of the concern of religion and science. In the history of these lectures, they have most often, if not exclusively, been filled by professional theologians and often by ordained clergy persons. So 1981 marks something of a distinction, I think, in the history of these lectures, because we have invited and had as our guest a very distinguished practicing natural scientist, as well as a devout layman of a Baptist congregation. So in many ways, it has, I think, offered us a rather unique opportunity to hear a scientist who happens also to be a believer to reflect upon this subject without the kind of prior conditioning that in any specialized academic community we often assimilate into our own way of seeing things. And so the result is we've heard some fresh and challenging ideas. There are two notable elements to me as I've reflected upon what I think has been a fine lecture series this week. One is that our lecturer has a remarkable ability to clarify for laypersons like ourselves, in science at least, some very complex scientific ideas. Not everyone can do that. And a second thing is, if a good lecture series is designed to provide a catalytic element in a community, he has surely done that, because he has stimulated an enormous amount of conversation and reflection and going back and rethinking some familiar ideas. So I personally have enjoyed this lectureship at a very high level, and I think as he comes now on this final lecture to share with us some of his ideas on the first chapter of Genesis, that on behalf of the community, and I think with the support of your applause, I want to thank our distinguished professor, William Tanner, for taking time from his work and putting his thoughts together and sharing his energies and his abilities with us this week at Southern Seminary. We welcome you for this last lecture.
To express to you my gratitude. I'm really not impressed a whole lot with applause, but I am impressed with the warmth in your hearts which leads you to that applause. And I feel very close to you and appreciate you very much. I appreciate those of you who have invited me here and those of you who were silent accomplices. Although you did not write a letter, you at least did not abandon the seminary. I appreciate particularly those of you who have stopped me on the campus and have shaken my hand and said, hello, welcome, we're glad to have you here. I would invite all of you to come visit me. No, I'm not going to do that. I would invite all of you to come visit me in Tallahassee, but not at once. If you do come into Tallahassee, I would be delighted to see you. I belong to Fellowship Baptist Church. I would be delighted to see you at that church. My pastor is a graduate of this seminary and thinks this is the center of the universe. Whereas some other pastors may think it's really in Nashville. I want to talk this morning as a geologist reading his Bible. That is, I bring certain perceptions that I get professionally to my reading of the Bible. I cannot avoid that. And As I read the first few chapters of Genesis, primarily the first chapter, secondarily the second chapter, but slopping over just a tiny bit into the third chapter, I see certain things there which are not geological in nature, and perhaps they don't touch on anything geological at all. I'll let you judge as we go along. First, let me review very briefly the various interpretations that I have heard for the first chapter of Genesis. And some of you know these by fancy names that you've had to learn in your classes, and some of you no doubt could make longer lists than I will make, but this is the group of interpretations that comes to my mind. Some people have held that the first chapter of Genesis is a beautiful poem. Oh, I think it is that. That it is the product of a true genius who has captured for us a series of very lofty thoughts, but there isn't anything in it. You're supposed to, according to this approach, you're supposed to read this chapter and sit there and feel inspired, but you don't learn anything. Some people have held that this account matches geology in detail. And some people have spent a great deal of time in an effort to show that the 6 days of Genesis, sorry, I don't have enough fingers, the 6 days of Genesis on one hand match the 6 eras of geology on the other hand. That's not true. We have only 3 standard eras in geology. If we count backwards for the year, we get immediately 3 months that you all recognize, December, November, October. If I count backwards into geological time, we have 3 standard eras, the Cenozoic, the Mesozoic, and the Paleozoic. And before the Paleozoic, we have a vast expanse of time, something like 4 billion years that we call Precambrian. And it is not divided into eras. All of this time in the Precambrian poses some problems for us in geology. The reason is pretty simple. In the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic, we have millions and millions of fossils, and they're easy to identify, and you can go into the hills and creek beds around Louisville and find them by the hundreds. Easy to find, easy to identify. And this gives us something to peg things to. What kind of fossils are here? It's not the only thing we peg things to, but it helps. In the Precambrian, although there are millions of fossils, they are tiny, they're microscopic, they are hard to find, they are hard to identify. And therefore, we do not have the same kind of framework. And so we don't have any convenient way to identify eras. Now, you will encounter books in which the author of the book identifies eras, but you must, in the Precambrian, but you must keep clearly in your thinking that these are his eras. And the chances are pretty good that nobody else will agree with him. So in geology, we have 3 eras, and then a vast expanse of time and nothing in it. Not in the way of eras. But it's very difficult to take 3 eras and a question mark and match that with 6 days. You might legitimately ask the question, well, maybe the last 3 eras match the last 3 days, and that will then tell us that probably when we get smart enough, we'll find the other 3 eras. That's not true either. The last 3 eras do not match the last 3 days. And some people take this as evidence that the Bible is bad, and some people take it as evidence that geology is bad, or maybe geologists are bad. I don't think you ought to go either road there. A third group has held that the first chapter of Genesis is totally unintelligible, and that the smart thing to do with it is to stay out. A fourth group holds that the author of Genesis wrote a well-abstracted summary of the legends and folklore available in his time, and that this summary provides an important landmark in the evolution of human thought. These people point out, for example, the flood legends, and observe that these stories are scattered widely across the face of the earth, so Genesis becomes a purified version of that. And if anybody else tells that story, that is not a purified version, but it is still legend for them, and is part of the fabricated and fanciful heritage which we have gotten from our forebears. I want to make a parenthesis here. Floods are geologically common occurrences. Anywhere where there's running water, any significant quantity of running water, you can have floods, and you do have floods. And even in places where it appears that there are no quantities of running water, we still get floods. And those of you who've lived in arid climates know about that. The flood legends among many people, such as some of the Western Hemisphere Indians, tell us about a general process on the surface of the planet. A fifth group has labeled Genesis as pro-God propaganda, which was invented to serve the selfish interests of the priesthood. The sixth idea is that the Genesis story is a compendium of some simple and important principles, but that we must not believe the details, that they are there only to illustrate the principles, and hence are hypothetical situations. The seventh and last on my list, and many of you will add others, I'm sure, is the idea that the early chapters of Genesis contain a straightforward, a precise, and reliable account of simple facts which have no interpretation other than the one that the interpreter wishes to put on them. This is the point of view held by many people who think that the earth was created one Saturday morning in October, about 6,000 years ago. Are any of these correct? Apparently sincere people believe them. All of them are believed by apparently sincere people, and I've heard sincere, well-educated, well-informed people expound some of these. I accept their statement that they believe them. But obviously some of them at least must be wrong. Many Christians think they believe number 7. It's a simple story. It's an open shut case, hands down. You don't have to worry about it. You just take it like it looks, and that tells the full story, and there isn't anything else. I don't really care for any of the 7. I think the early chapters of Genesis are much too rich for us to drop into simple accounts like that. I'd like for us to examine a decalogue, 10 words, 10 ideas that appeal to me as transcending some of these various ideas that I mentioned a moment ago. But before I look at those 10 ideas, I would like to take an aside for a moment and look at some other things. Let's see if we can't straighten out one very common misconception that's been actively advocated by a number of people. This idea presumes that nature tells us about God and that the Bible tells us about God, and therefore that the two of them must tell us the same story. God's in the business of redundancy at that point, and all of the details must agree from one to the other. I think it is obvious that this is not true. Genesis chapter 1 is not a geology textbook. Don't use it as one. I would not use it as one. It is not a summary of astronomical knowledge or biological knowledge or meteorological knowledge. It's not a textbook in the sciences or in anything else as far as that goes. This is not to say that it contains errors. But it is a recognition that a person who writes a textbook on one hand and the author of Genesis on the other hand have quite different purposes and therefore make quite different selections from the vast amount of material that is available. I'm a little suspicious of some of the computer studies that have been made that purport to show that one particular book in the Bible could not have been written by somebody who wrote another book in the Bible because they used some list of words in a different number of times. I have written over the years almost 300 professional monographs, books, and scientific research papers. There was a time in my life when I wrote a number of letters to a young lady who later became my wife. I think if you made a computer analysis of these two bodies of literature, you would find that they were written by two different people. The textbook is limited by and large to what is replicable in a scientific sense. In a mechanical sense, the textbook presents, by and large, and I'm aware of errors and misstatements and confusion, the textbook presents, by and large, material which any reader can be assured of duplicating if he makes a mechanically correct effort. The Bible does not. There is no mechanical procedure taught in the Bible that will give us assured spiritual results merely because we invest enough time, effort, and money in a mechanical fashion. The 8th chapter of Acts is instructive there. The Bible deals with the realm of the spiritual, where algebra does not hold, where there are no numerical conversion factors, no universal coefficients that you can express in Arabic numerals. All of the rest of the Bible is background. Let me say that again. The Bible deals primarily with spiritual matters. All of the rest of the Bible is background. I don't question any part of it, but it's background. I do not wish to impute error. I do wish to say that a primarily spiritual account of a series of events is markedly different from a physical account or a chemical account. So, we don't learn chemistry or physics or geology. I've heard people say that we do. We do not. From the Bible. I'd also like to point out for you that there are two creation accounts in the Bible, and for some strange reason we love one of them in the first chapter of Genesis and we have no use for the other one in the second chapter of Genesis. I've not seen any Creation Research Society publication yet that says that the earth was created in one day. But the second chapter of Genesis does. If we're going to accept the Bible as any kind of a record of, at all, I think we need to accept both accounts. The second account tells us that it was done in one day. If you were here for the discussion yesterday, I spent a great deal of effort trying to persuade you that the word day means what the word day means and that you are not free to impose on it your personal biases. And when Genesis 1 says day, it means one thing. And when Genesis 2 says day, it means something else. And let's not get picky about whether we can dictate to the writer what those meanings were. I'd like to mention one other point here. The Genesis account is an historical account. I believe that because I see a sequence that is present, I see the use of a time word, even though we don't know what it means there, the word day, some other time words in there also, and I see it by the logical pattern in which the account builds from an infrastructure to a suprastructure. But a history always has a complication that we tend to forget unless we lived through that history. This says that the errors into which we divide it are artificial. They are designed to help us in retaining some key facts in our memories. We almost always divide a history into time periods of some kind, don't we? Days or ages or eras or period or intervals or reigns of a king or governments or something. For example, in human history, we had the Stone Age at one time. When was it over? Don't be silly. We've got people who are in the edge of the Stone Age today. Not over yet. We've had a Bronze Age. Some of us will say we live in an Atomic Age. We have an Industrial Age. We have a Computer Age. Kids are carrying them in their hip pockets. Can't add anymore, but they've got computers. We have a Space Age. Real spacey. How about the Age of Enlightenment, whatever that is? The Age of Public Education. The Age of Women's Rights, or was it female emancipation, or am I mixed up in my history? Or the Age of Instant Coffee and Bako Bits. And some others. These ages or eras or days do not form a continuum. They overlap, and they're interwoven in complicated patterns. This is the way we build a history. A history textbook might very well take them up one at a time. But the ages themselves certainly did not evolve in a sequential order. Have a hard time discussing them if we did not use a sequential order. There's no particular reason for thinking that the days of Genesis are any more nearly simple, uniform, sequential, non-overlapping, and linear than are the ages of human history. It is instead, and I will share with you an illustration that appeals to me. I like things on a very simple level. I heard Dr. George Crane once say that he never heard an idea presented so simply that a kid could not understand it. And I like that very much. I'll share with you one of my favorite illustrations. It's almost as if the writer of Genesis were describing a three-ring circus. His account must be sequential, but the circus is not. It's a mistake to assign a fixed unit of time to each of the ages, to string them together like a string of pearls, or for me, a string of paper clips, and then to postulate that this rigid framework is a necessary piece of baggage for the true believer. Of course, God is capable of doing this. This is an article of faith for me. But all of the detailed history in the Bible shows that he did not do it like this. Instead, ages or eras or days or what have you overlap. They have various lengths. They have various interrelationships with each other. And it is only we who look back into time and compartmentalize them. Okay, what do I learn from the Genesis accounts? And I wish to list 10 items. Number one, I learn that God is supreme. He is the creator. This for me is a tremendous thought. He designed and planned, invented everything that was necessary. Putting the system together, the materials, the energy, the processes, and he brought all of this together so that the result was a system which did not exist before and which functions the way he wanted it to function. He did not merely rearrange things from a previous state of affairs that he inherited from somebody else. Instead, he designed a system that was something new. That is, he is a creator rather than a rearranger. He is a designer rather than a repairman. He is a planner rather than a mender. The system that he created is so vast and complicated, so difficult for us to perceive and to fathom, that there cannot be anyone else remotely close to him. Therefore, he is supreme. Number two, he runs a rational universe. I really find that in Genesis, yes. There is a substrate of accountancy throughout the creation account, the book's balance at every step of the way. Time is divided into rational units. You and I don't know what they are. We have no hint, really, as to what they are. But it's a rational system. Just because I don't know what it is doesn't put it into the world of the irrational. It does not matter that the day is not a constant unit in length. It is important that the day is a rational unit. It does not matter that the events ascribed to one day may have spilled over into some other days. It is important that there was a logical sequence of some kind. It does not matter how long a day was. It is important that the work of each day was inspected in detail, and that the system was found to be functioning perfectly, not capriciously, not randomly, not erratically. A rational universe, a universe which was the product of God's deep thoughts, a logical universe, a consistent universe. Science is a human reaction to a rational universe. Without a rational universe, there is no science. We place severe limits on the way in which we react. If we stress in an investigation, if we stress replication and verification, then we're doing the work of science, which sets us apart from some other fields like art and music, where if you are inspired to write a tune, and I in some way should happen to be inspired to write a tune, they do not have to be the same. The tremendous success that science has in itself is a tribute to the rational nature of the universe. Number three, pantheism, however you paint it, cannot be entertained. We do not worship the stars in tribal ritual. You and I don't. Or in astronomy, or in astrology. Astrology may be the number one avenue of worship in the United States today. We do not venerate nature except at a relatively low level. We do not believe that the universe has always been there, and therefore that it is the essence of what is important. Pantheism can be dressed up in some fancy terms, and maybe you know some of them, and it may sound very logical to us. But if Genesis is part of God's inspired word, then pantheism must be rejected. In the fourth place, we do not fear the forces of nature. And this one is difficult, either remote or close at hand, because God created them and they're part of his system. It is hard if you're trapped in the middle of a hot, flowing lava field which is spreading toward you, not to be afraid. Every Christian comes to the end of his life, And many Christians will do that in the context of a flood, a hurricane, a landslide, a lava flow, a volcanic eruption, an earthquake, some natural event. But Jesus told us how to look at these matters and said that instead of that, we are to fear the source of spiritual death. Instead of that, we are to fear the source of spiritual death. Therefore, we do not fear the stars or portents or natural events. I have been killed a couple of times in several different ways. I was in a transatlantic steamer when it went over past the imbalance point. And you know what happens then? It goes on over and it sinks and you drown. You don't swim away from that. But a wave caught us at just the right moment and in just the right way, and you may call that a miracle if you like. I don't give it that much credit. And so even though we were several degrees past the critical point, we came back. Okay, I was dead. Was it frightening? Of course. Maybe that's a measure of the fact that I need to grow up some more. Jesus said, don't be afraid of those things. God made them. He's not surprised by them. And he knows that we have trouble coping with them. Number five, we're not to confuse creator and creation, such as in idolatry. Most of us will deny that we worship idols. We are aware of the commandment that tells us that we are not to worship idols, and we commonly think that an idol is like a totem pole with ugly carvings on it, only much smaller. And we don't worship anything like that. That's in the state of Washington, or maybe Alaska, or some other place. But we have other idols, and we're not always able to draw the line carefully between respect and worship. Some of us worship the faces of Washington, Lincoln, Hamilton, Jackson, and Grant, printed in black ink on a pale green background. But they are not creators, they are creatures. That's the paper money sequence, in case you don't know whose faces you carry around with you. The Genesis account makes the distinction clearly, and it's our business to make the distinction equally clearly. Six, man has an animal body, but he is not an animal. He himself is a higher creation. The making of the universe was carried out on a mechanical level, an organic level, and a spiritual level. Each of the first two built the platform on which the rest were then built. It is easy, I think, in the first chapter of Genesis to separate these three levels. I don't see any problem at all. The earth, the moon, the sun, the stars, the oceans, the land, these constitute the mechanical part of the system. After it was functioning, then we go into the biological part of the system and create animals. Don't tell me that plants come earlier. Plants did not count at that time. It's only we later who have decided that they do count. And only after the biological part could be completed could God turn to the spiritual level. If these levels cannot be distinguished, then the rest of the Bible is a farce. Spiritual matters have no significance. If these levels cannot be distinguished, then God, the pattern after which man was designed, is only a biological being. We ought to be able to find him somewhere. And references to his spirit are meaningless. If these cannot be distinguished, then the death of Jesus on the cross was an empty symbol. What do you think God created on the sixth day? Just told you what I think he created. What do you think he created on the sixth day? Just another physical entity which shares its measurements with those of the large apes? Just another creature with four appendages like a chimpanzee or a gorilla? In Genesis 1, verse 26, And following, we are told that man was created in the image of God. This must be a statement about a spiritual origin. It's reasoned back from God, then to the image, and then to man. And it has nothing to do with the procedure that God used to make the human body. Number seven, as spiritual beings, we have the privilege of making choices. Don't misunderstand me. A dog can make a choice. A cockroach can make a choice. As spiritual beings, we have a privilege of making a choice. I think this is clearly taught in Genesis. If you can't find that, I'll show it to you. If you can't find it any sooner than that, I'll show it to you in the third chapter. But you can find it sooner than that. Let's not get all tied up in the story of whether or not it's possible to make a free choice. I hear people argue you can't make a free choice, therefore you can't make a choice. I disagree. We have privileges of choosing, and this statement is not destroyed by the fact that sometimes we must choose among good things, and sometimes we must choose among choices when all of them are bad. Our ability to make choices is not canceled by the fact that in some instances it is of no concern to God that we take one choice instead of another. Study again the story of Adam naming the animals. It is true that animals can make choices, and in some instances they choose aesthetic values over mundane things, such as the story of the baboon in the wilds of Africa who elected to miss supper in order to enjoy a beautiful sunset. Listen, if all you can do is look at it and say it's beautiful, you're right next to him. Spirituality is not the same thing as aesthetics. If I understand this statement about the image of God in Genesis, man has been given the ability to make choices having important spiritual and moral consequences. Even more, he has been given the privilege of making this choice inside or outside of the framework that we recognize when we choose to worship God. Number eight, man has been appointed to a management function, and he's accountable for how he handles that function. He cannot be appointed if he doesn't have the ability to make reasoned choices. The appointment is stated in the first chapter of Genesis, where mankind was instructed, according to some translations, to subdue the earth. This cannot be a command to exploit, that is, to subdue in a bad way, in a destructive fashion, but rather must be a command to subdue in a more rational fashion. The word subdue and some of its substitutes could be replaced by a word that I prefer, and I don't know whether it's a good translation or not. We have been instructed to administer the earth. That is, we must run it properly for the benefit of the authority who made the appointment in the first place. All administrators have been designated to carry out their duties for the benefit of the appointing authority. Only when we ourselves receive an appointment do we have the brass to argue that we've been given free rein to run things we want to for our own personal benefit. Many an administrator has been fired. Have you ever been fired? If you haven't, you've missed an extremely important experience in life. One should have been fired once. Many an administrator has been fired because he did not understand clearly the chain of command. God doesn't always operate in that fashion. Sometimes he lets us struggle with the wreckage that we make. If I own a business and I have a manager who's wrecking the business, I'm not going to sit around and be patient like God is patient. Sometimes he lets us face the shortages and the handicaps which we have brought on ourselves because we've done a sorry job of administering things. I think all facets of this teaching are given in the first few chapters of Genesis. Where man was appointed as an administrator, he was given an official title, supervisor of agriculture. He was, it's there. And then he was fired and banished to a less important position because in making choices that were available to him, he elected a course of action that was not in keeping with his appointment. Science is one of the tools that we have developed for exploring and administering the earth, but let us not blame scientists for our troubles any more than we blame non-scientists. When a scientist makes a discovery that has the potential for working out badly, nothing of importance happens until non-scientists pick it up and apply it on a large scale. That is, we are all co-administrators, and I refuse to take all of the blame. Average people making choices, some of which constitute exploitation. We've used up much, much more than half of our domestic crude oil supply, maybe about four-fifths. Sorry, I said that wrong. Maybe about three-fifths. And we're now paying tens of billions of dollars a year to other countries to let us use up their supply. So that right after we run out, they'll run out. And this figure this year will be very close to $100 billion. We are exploiting farmland and forest, water supplies and air and many, many other things. The way we are doing it constitutes bad management, and I do not think that the owner is pleased. Number nine. The Genesis account teaches me very clearly the sacredness of the bipolar family. We must not take the view that when mankind was created, male and female, that this constitutes the creation of sex. Sex was created much earlier, certainly no later than the creation of other animal life. And if you have a biological point of view, no later than the creation of plant life. The creation of mankind as male and female establishes the bipolar family. And by bipolar, I mean that the family is built around two different kinds of entities, each of which has characteristics that the other one does not have, and each of one brings attributes that the other one cannot bring. God did not merely create people, he created the family. The Christian marriage ceremony today is for me a recognition that God created something special in the spiritual realm, which is not duplicated anywhere else. From this I infer that the family is primarily a spiritual creation, and it is merely visible to us in the forms of the two people who join together to nurture it. Number 10. The Genesis account draws back the curtain from a very deep and a very difficult secret. As far as difficulty is concerned, all of the others pale into insignificance compared with this one. God requires obedience. It is a popular fallacy among Christians and lots of other people also that God designed and assembled the universe, whoever God is and whatever he did, doesn't matter much, but he did it, set it all in motion as a platform on which you and I are to spend our allotted days trying to get what we want to get and do what we want to do. And as good Christians, we ought to be praying for him to help us do that. I don't believe that. I believe God has a purpose, and I believe He has given us several purposes, and we can certainly pick out some of them. One of them is to administer the planet. Unlike a seminary, which is not here to be administered, the planet is. Another one is that we should foster the family, and another one is that we should worship and serve Him. None of these involve the business of entertaining ourselves. I've got nothing against entertainment, but it must be lower on the pecking order, and it's not a primary purpose. I think Christian fun does exist. I think you can have a sense of humor. I admire very much one of your Louisville residents, Grady Nutt. But it's not first in the list. If we are to administer the planet, if we're going to recognize the Creator, if we're going to worship the Creator, then we must fit into the chain of command. And this chain of command is quite clear, and half of it goes up. That is, we are required to obey Him. We have the option of refusing, don't we? And that carries certain consequences. The first chapters of Genesis spell this out in detail, in almost painful detail. It is spelled out in our administrative assignment, and it is spelled out in a story that's so popularly misquoted as eating an apple, with well-known results. It would seem to be such a clear and simple and obvious idea, but it must be a very difficult idea. I have a great deal of trouble with it. And I observe that other people have a lot of trouble with it. It's very difficult. It would seem to be almost superficial, but it isn't. It must be very deep, because I have trouble exploring it. And I see others have trouble exploring it. It must be difficult and deep, because it lies at the heart of the work, the creative work that Jesus did on the cross. The work on the cross, the solution to the puzzle, is not given to us in Genesis. That's an aside. But the puzzle is in Genesis. Right now, it looks like that the earth was created that the universe was created in the Big Bang explosion about 20 or 30 billion years ago, and I understand that the morning paper has a little item that casts a little more fuel on the flames, discredits a previous theory, and tends to support the Big Bang theory a little bit. The universe is supposed to be expanding, being blown outward from this initial explosion, and to have been expanding for billions of years. But it is true that the Big Bang theory was not always the reigning hypothesis. And in fact, scientists have vacillated among many theories. Who is to say that in October 1981, you and I know all of the answers, and tomorrow there will be no changes? Suppose the Big Bang theory turns out eventually to be correct. Well, it doesn't do anything more than describe a sequence of events. It says nothing about the cause of the explosion. It doesn't say who set it off. It doesn't say what preceded it. It doesn't say how everything in the universe could be packed into one little package. The Genesis account, on the other hand, is not concerned with any of this. The actual duration of the history is of no consequence. How God packed things together does not matter. But if the theory called the Big Bang Theory is wrong, not a single teaching of Genesis will be damaged. One starts with the rocks. Talking about me. One starts with the rocks, or the stars, or the clouds, or the oceans. And then, if he wishes, he can reason backward to the Creator. And in the things of science, I can find plenty of evidence to help me in my worship of God. I have spent a professional career doing this. But the bottom line has to do with what this worship experience does to the way I live.